Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNRadio.com/Behind the Badge.
And now, here with an unlimited supply of misinformation, is Mr. Know-It-All.
John, I love your show.
So, thank you, Ryan. It's 1:09, so we'll pause this show as soon as the president and Angela Merkel are in the same room answering questions. Is that the plan?
Yeah, let's do that. There's some movement now going on, so it should be happening here very soon.
So we'll join live coverage of the Q and the A. I guess I didn't understand this. Each of them get two questions? Is it one from our reporter, one from their reporter?
Yeah, it seems like that's going to be the case, yeah.
And I guess this is a big deal. Because, you know, it's a big deal, but also because President Trump has been particularly critical of the German chancellor in the past. And so now the two of them will be standing side by side. If you got to ask Donald Trump one question right now, what would it be? He'll field one maybe from our side. Okay, now here they're walking up to the microphones, aren't they?
Do you want me to pull that up from here?
Yeah, here we go.
Let's do it.
Chancellor Merkel, it is a great honor to welcome you to the People's House, the White House.
She's wearing green.
Our two nations share much in common, including our desire for security, prosperity, and peace. We just concluded a productive meeting with the German and American companies to discuss workforce development and vocational training. Very important words. Germany has done an incredible job training the employees and future employees, and employing its manufacturing and industrial workforce. It's crucial that we provide our American workers with a really great employment outlook. And that includes making sure that we harness the full potential of women in our economy. My administration is in the process of rebuilding the American industrial base. A stronger America is in the interest, believe me, of the world as a whole. I reiterated to Chancellor Merkel my strong support for NATO, as well as the need for our NATO allies to pay their fair share for the cost of defense. Many nations owe vast sums of money from past years, and it is very unfair to the United States. These nations must pay what they owe. During our meeting, I thanked Chancellor Merkel for the German government's commitment to increase defense spending and work toward contributing at least 2% of GDP. I want to thank the Chancellor for her leadership in supporting NATO and its efforts in Afghanistan.
President Trump continuing with his remarks. Angela Merkel will as well. They'll be in German and then translated. So what we're waiting for, the Q&A, and we'll be getting to that in just a couple of minutes. And in advance of that, so we don't have to play commercials on top of them then, let's do this now on WGN. Angela Merkel is still speaking. We'll go to the Q&A as she and President Trump are standing side by side at podiums at the White House. Steve, I just don't know if we even have time, but if there was one story that Ryan did a minute ago.
Yeah, Ryan's here with us. He can handle this.
Okay, so Ryan, do you have that copy again?
Yeah, I do.
I heard that and I went, oh, blah, blah.
Yeah.
What?
Well, we actually just got a release from the United States Secret Service saying they can confirm that an employee was the victim of a criminal act in which our agency-issued laptop computer was stolen. Secret Service-issued laptops contain multiple layers of security, including full-disk encryption, and are not permitted to contain classified information.
Okay.
An investigation is ongoing. The Secret Service is withholding additional comment until the facts are gathered. What we're hearing, it was initially reported in the New York Daily News. ABC has confirmed that that the laptop itself was in a vehicle in Brooklyn and was stolen yesterday, and they've been frantically looking for this thing. It does apparently have information that's very sensitive. However, based on what Secret Service says, there look like there are a lot of different bells and whistles you got to get through to get to that information.
And what did you say? Didn't you say like the floor plan of some buildings was
floor plan of Trump Tower, some of the investigation into Hillary Clinton's emails, a lot of very sensitive stuff on there. We don't know if whoever has this laptop knew what it was they got. It might have just been a smash and grab situation, you know, petty theft, not realizing how valuable this was, but they are taking it very seriously.
Right. Well, that's intriguing, isn't it? So is it a targeted theft where somebody was like going to dig for this, or is it just some bozo now that's going to go, this thing doesn't work, and he's going to chuck it?
Have you never seen a Jason Bourne movie? There are no accidents.
And he's going to take it to, a Best Buy, and he's going to use the Geek Squad, and he's going to go, I don't know, there's this encryption thing. Can you help me out?
Yeah, and then they're gonna hack it, and all of a sudden have access to all this. And,
and then that scene where all of a sudden stuff rapidly starts populating on the screen, and you go, oh, I think we got something here.
But with all these concerns about security and hacking and breaches, I mean, this just kind of adds to that, to the discussion we've been having for months now.
Guess what, world? We don't need this. We got enough on our plate right now. Every day it's something new, and the last thing you want to hear is, oh, and by the way, the people with all the stuff on the computer, someone stole the computer. I mean, what layer does that add to the whole who's hacking who's got poop on whom kind of conversation? Maybe nothing, but it's just it's a whole area I don't want them to touch.
The one thing I can tell you is they do have surveillance video from the location where this was stolen, so they're kind of combing through that information. They may know or at least have a good idea who this person is.
This is why I'm not in the Secret Service, by the way. Actually, a number of reasons, but one of them would be they'd go, hey, John, do you have that top secret computer with all of the codes and the floor plan to Trump Tower and the email hack stuff? And I go, oh, God, yes, I do. And they go, where is that? Because it's not here. And I'd go,
you'd look in your backpack. You'd feel around in your pockets like somehow it magically ended up in there.
Right. I'd be
like you lost your keys.
This is one thing you do not want to see your Secret Service agent doing. Oh, gee. And then going, Elif, where is that computer thing with all the stuff that could end the world? You know, the one with the nuclear codes. Where is that one? That's very bad news for America and the whole planet that we share. We'll wait for Angela Merkel and Donald Trump's opening remarks to close, and then we'll take the Q&A segment of what will be a brief press conference they're having. In the meantime, how about those cats? You know, I'm happy for the Wildcats. I mean, that's an understatement, isn't it? I'm so happy that Northwestern Nation now has its victory.
Can I interrupt you? I'm sorry to do that, but Mark Halperin is asking a question now. So they've just started. It looks like a President Trump.
Tell people what your bottom lines are, what's non-negotiable. We talked in the past about saying no one should deny health insurance if they can't afford it. We talked about no.
The gentleman needs to use a microphone.
Are those your part of your bottom line? Would you veto anything?
Well, you heard the translator there, but the question is, what is your bottom line when it comes to this health care bill?
President Trump's got a different style than some most recent past U.S. presidents. I'm wondering what you think of that style, if you think it's good. World,
oh, this is for Angela asking about Trump's style. Okay. So,
thank you, Mark. We just have a really wonderful group of people meeting later. We met with 12 pretty much no's in Congress. You saw that a little while ago. And they went from all no's to all yeses. And we have a lot of yeses coming in. It's all coming together. We're going to have great health care. It's going to be passed, I believe, I think, substantially and pretty quickly. It's coming together beautifully. You have the conservative groups. You have other groups. Everybody wants certain things. In the end, we're going to have a great health care plan. Now, I have to tell you that Obamacare is a disaster. It's failing. I was in Tennessee. We had a tremendous crowd the other night. And they have half of the state is uncovered. The insurance companies have left. And the other half has one insurance company. And that'll probably be bailing out pretty soon also. They have nobody. You have many states where they have one, and you have a lot of places now where they'll have none. Obamacare will fail. It will fold. It will close up very, very soon if something isn't done. I've often said politically the best thing I can do is absolutely nothing. Wait 1 year, and then even the Democrats will come say, please, please, you got to help us. But it's not the right thing to do for the people. We have a great plan. We have a plan that's getting more and more popular with the Republican base, with the conservative base, and with people generally. The press has covered it very inaccurately. People are truly covered well. And I think it's going to be something that's going to be a model to be looked upon. I'll tell you after we're finished.
Now, hopefully she answers
the
other question.
Thank you very much. Well, I'm here as Chancellor of the Federal Republic of Germany. I represent German interests. I speak with the President of the United States who, stands up for, as is right, American interests. That is our task, respectively. And I must say that I was very gratified to know the very warm and gracious hospitality with which I've been received here. We held a conversation where we were trying to address also those areas where we disagree, but to try to bring people together, try to show what is our vantage point, what is the American vantage point, and then try to find a compromise, which is good for both sides, because we need to be fair with each other. Each and everyone is expecting for his or her leader that something good comes out of it for their own people. For Germany, I can say, well, people are different. People have different abilities, have different characteristics, traits of character, have different origins, have found their way into politics along different pathways, that is diversity, which is good. Sometimes it's difficult to find compromises, but that's what we've been elected for. If everything just went like that without problem, we didn't need politicians to do these jobs.
Frau Dunz.
Ms. Dunz, please. Christina Dunz from the German press agency. Madam Chancellor, given the experience of the GDR, you are always saying that you are so confident that walls can fall also. For how dangerous do you think this isolationist policy of the U.S. president is, what with the import tariffs that he plans, and also with the fact that he doesn't think the EU doesn't deal with the EU in a very respectful way? And, Mr. President, America first, don't you think that this is going to weaken also the European Union? And why are you so scared of diversity in the news and in the media, that you speak so often of fake news and that things, after all, in the end cannot be proven? For example, the fact that you have been wiretapped by Mr. Obama.
Nice, friendly reporter. Well, first of all, I don't believe in an isolationist policy, but I also believe a policy of trade should be a fair policy. And the United States has been treated very, very unfairly by many countries over the years, and that's going to stop. But I'm not an isolationist. I'm a free trader, but I'm also a fair trader. And our free trade has led to a lot of bad things happening. You look at the deficits that we have, and you look at all of the accumulation of debt. We're a very powerful country. We're a very strong country. We'll soon be at a level that we perhaps have never been before. Our military is going to be strengthened. It's been depleted. But I am a trader. I am a fair trader. I am a trader that wants to see good for everybody worldwide. But I am not an isolationist by any stretch of the imagination. So I don't know what newspaper you're reading, but I guess that would be another example of, as you say, fake news.
Also, ich möchte es einfach mal so.
Well, allow me, if I may, to put it in the following terms. We haven't yet had time to talk at a great length about economic issues, but I would so say that the success of Germany in the economic area, but also on security and peace, that the success of Germans have always been one where the German success is one side of the coin and the other side of the coin has been European unity and European integration. That's something of which I'm deeply convinced, and I'm not only saying this back home, I'm saying this here, I'm saying it in the United States and also here in Washington in my talks with the president. Secondly, I believe that globalization ought to be shaped in an open-minded way, but also in a very fair way. Freedom of movement within the European Union, for example, is a very important element of our economic progress, of peace, has been for many, many decades. The European countries for many, many centuries waged wars against each other. we have to protect our external borders because, and there we have to work in on the basis of mutual interest with our neighbors. Migration, immigration, integration has to be worked on. Obviously, traffickers have to be stopped, but this has to be done by looking at the refugees as well, giving them opportunities to shape their own lives where they are, help countries who right now are not in an ability to do so, sometimes because they have civil war. I think that's the right way of going about it. And this is obviously what we have an exchange of views about. My position is the one that I've just set out for you.
I might add that we have many plants and factories coming back into the United States. Many jobs are coming back to Michigan, to Ohio, to Pennsylvania, to a lot of places where they were losing jobs. And we will have a different policy, but it's going to be a great policy for not only the United States, but a great policy worldwide. And I look very much forward to it. Kevin Cerulli.
You're listening to live coverage of a joint news conference with German Chancellor Angela Merkel and President Trump at the White House. You can hear the format where each reporter, there will be four total, I believe, will ask a question of each leader. I apologize. It's difficult to hear the question.
Well, Kevin, I think we have a very unified Republican Party. After all, we have the presidency, we have the House, we have the Senate, and we're getting along very well, I will tell you. And if you would have were at the meeting that I just attended, where we took 12 no's or semi-no's, no yeses, and within a short period of time, everybody was very much on board and a commitment to vote yes. I think we have a very unified party. I think actually more unified than even the election. You see, when they talk about me, I seem to be very popular, at least this week, within the party, because we have our highest numbers, the highest numbers that I've ever had in the party. So I think there's a great unification. Healthcare is a very, very difficult subject. It's a very complex subject, and it's a subject that, you know, goes both ways. You do something for one side, and the other side doesn't like it. But it's really something that's come together very well, and I think it's going to be very, very popular, extremely popular. On trade with Germany, I think we're going to do fantastically well. Right now, I would say that the negotiators for Germany have done a far better job than the negotiators for the United States. But hopefully we can even it out. We don't want victory. We want fairness. All I want is fairness. Germany's done very well in its trade deals with the United States, and I give them credit for it. But and I can speak to many other countries. I mean, you look at China, you look at virtually any country that we do business with, it's not exactly what you call good for our workers. I mean, you look at the horrible NAFTA transaction. NAFTA has been a disaster for the United States. It's been a disaster for companies, and in particular, it's been a disaster for the workers. A lot of the companies just moved. But the workers are screwed. It's probably the reason I'm standing here. Maybe number one, that, and maybe the military, building up our military, which we will do, and we will be stronger than ever before, and hopefully not have to use it. But we will be stronger and perhaps far stronger than ever before. But it's probably the reason I'm here is when you talk about trade. So I think that we are going to be a very different country. I think we're going to be have great values. But in terms of our military, it's going to be much stronger. And our trade deals are going to be good, solid deals, not deals that lead to closing plants and tremendous unemployment. Okay? Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
When we speak about trade agreements, then the European Union is negotiating those agreements for all of the member states of the European Union. But obviously, there's also input by the member states. They bring to the table what's important to them. We have underlined as German industry, German business community, and have made the experience that any kind of agreement that we have concluded, for example, at the very latest with South Korea, brought us more jobs, actually. People were very much concerned about losing jobs, for example, the automotive industry. But in the end, it turned out, particularly as regards South Korea, in the end, it turned out that both sides benefited. And I think it's only fair. That's the purpose of concluding agreements, that both sides win. And that is the sort of spirit, I think, in which we ought to be guided in negotiating any agreement between the United States of America and the EU. I hope that we can resume the agreement that we started. We have just now concluded our agreement with Canada, and I hope that we will come back to the table and talk about the agreement between EU and the U.S. again.
You've been listening to live coverage of a White House news conference with German Chancellor Angela Merkel and President Bush. President Trump, you know, can I just say in my head I said Obama and corrected myself to Bush. So that was
well, in my head, I was playing back the scene from Love Actually, where Hugh Grant is the Prime Minister of Great Britain and he's standing next to Billy Bob Thornton playing a Clinton like U.S. president. And then the British Prime Minister, in this case, I was wondering, I wonder if Angela Merkel is just going to drop it and go, you know what? No, diplomacy, I'm not going to do that anymore. And then just say how she really feels.
Yeah, she came but closer a little bit.
She did not go all Hugh Grant in that. I'm sorry, Steve.
If I can say one thing, we're getting guidance from ABC, and so this is theirs, not mine. They're in a better position to say this. But you've heard several times today the president say that he had a meeting with all no's. Republican members of Congress,
12 of them,
Republicans who were all against the health care bill and who left the meeting with him being all yeses. Here's the guidance from ABC. The president was not meeting with his staunch opponents today. Two in the room were members of House leadership, the leadership pushing this bill. Based on our tracking, most members in today's meeting were already leaning toward yes, with the exception of one, Representative Palmer, who as recently as yesterday still had significant reservations. So the president of the United States today saying that he turned 12 votes by ABC's count, that is not what happened today.
You know, listening to that exchange between Angela Merkel and President Trump and the press corps, you've got the language barriers, et cetera, et cetera. So it would never be smooth. But I thought it was interesting. And I also think it would be really interesting, just for dramatic sake. I'm sure President Trump doesn't want to do this. Maybe civilization wouldn't benefit from it. But for him to do a press conference like he can do with international press, just let them ask their questions because clearly they're interested.
Well, you know, he did have an interesting exchange with the BBC reporter at his last full news conference. Remember that, when the BBC gave his... gave its slogan, and, you know, the president goes, oh, here we go.
Oh, really? No, I don't remember.
Yeah,
that.
There was quite an exchange between the two of them. The BBC guy gave it right back to the president, which isn't, you know, something
what you're supposed to do.
Exactly.
That's Jim Acosta's job, for crying out loud.
I guess so, yeah.
I'll get to that a little later on. Thank you, Steve Bertrand. It's 1:41. This is WGN. Hi, I'm John Williams. There was a story in Time magazine recently. In fact, it's just online right now, and it says, here's what Uber drivers actually think about the company's PR nightmares. And then it goes on to say this, more than 200,000 Uber users reportedly stopped using the app in late January as part of the recent Delete Uber movement. There's a hashtag for it. Former Uber engineer Susan Fowler wrote that scathing account about the sexist, chaotic environment in which people work. There was the video of the CEO of the company getting into an argument with an Uber driver. And there's been descriptions of the workplace as being hostile to women. My son recently said, that's it, I'm never taking Uber again. And now he uses Lyft or walks, or we got him a jetpack for Christmas. I still use Uber, and I use it a lot lately. I find myself loving that company. So what to make of all of this? We thought we would ask the transportation writer for the Chicago Tribune to come into our studio and chat this up a little bit. How are you, Mary? Nice to see you again.
Good. Nice to see you.
Mary Wisniewski's here. She writes about transportation issues for the Chicago Tribune. And in fact, we'll have a page one story in the Sunday edition on a different topic, right?
Right.
The headline of that is going to be what?
It's going to be how more tickets are given in black neighborhoods than in other neighborhoods in Chicago for bicycle citations.
bicycle citations. You're more likely to get one in Austin than you are in Lincoln Park.
That's right.
That's shocking to me. Okay, that's page one in Sunday's Tribune. What do you make of this Uber story? My question to you before you came into the studio was, is Uber a bad company, and therefore should I boycott them because of all of this stuff?
Uber has brought it depends on your point of view. If you're an out-of-work person who was able to pick up a job as an Uber driver and has been able to make money that way and put food on the table, it's a great company. If you are someone who is frustrated with not being able to get a cab in your neighborhood, if you live in a neighborhood that's not well served by cabs, Uber has been a lifesaver for you. And it's also, and of course, if you're a cab driver, you find that Uber has really, really cut into your business and has really changed the way things are operating. However, all of this recent news about Uber, the allegation that women in management are not treated well, the report by the New York Times that they were using technology to thwart law enforcement that didn't want them in their towns, they said they were going to stop using that technology, and also the fact that drivers have been complaining that they don't make as much money as they used to because of this new Uber pool.
But none of that's my problem. I'm sorry, then don't drive for Uber. My Uber experiences have been positive. I mean, they're very quick to my door. Every time I've been in it, it's been a clean vehicle. They even ask what kind of music I want on the app or in the vehicle. The drivers have been respectful. They know where they're going. I haven't had one service complaint about Uber.
My experience has been great as well. I think that where Uber might have to worry is, right here in Chicago, Lyft, which is the rival rideshare provider, one of the rivals, has been making great strides. They've been adding more people. They are planning a new headquarters for drivers in the Avondale area. And if you're the kind of people that Uber appeals to, a lot of them are young, tech-savvy people who like to choose which brand is the good brand, which brand is the hip brand.
Really?
And if these people are starting to hear stories that Uber is, not, the kind of company I'd like to associate with, they have a choice with Lyft. And I think Lyft is taking advantage of that with, they're offering deals. They're really trying to make inroads into different markets.
Do you
here.
Think one is better than the other just as a rider?
I haven't noticed a difference as a rider, but I have talked to the drivers and some of the Lyft drivers say that they are happier. There was there's a guy who, a driver who runs a blog called The Rideshare Guy, and he does annual surveys about what people are happy with. And in general, Lyft drivers are happier than Uber drivers because they make more money. Lyft allows you to tip, and this makes them happier, and they can keep back more of their income.
I tip Uber drivers sometimes with cash.
Oh, well, that's an innovative of you, John.
Really, is that unusual?
I haven't heard many people do that, but I think it's very cool that you do.
Well, there was one instance where there was several complications, and the guy was terrific, and we got out. I tipped him about what I would have tipped a cab driver for the ride and all of the circumstances, and he seemed to be surprised now that you mention it.
Well, in Lyft, they build it right into the app. You can add it, and just like when you pay with a credit card in a cab, you can do that electronically.
Yeah, well, good for them, I guess. But still, that's not affecting me as an Uber customer, for instance, do people do this? Do they stop shopping at grocery stores because they hear there is a problem at the corporate headquarters? Or do they, I understand how boycotts work, but I have not felt compelled to treat Uber differently. And I don't know what your Uber experience is like. My number is 312-981-7200. I kind of like to know, but I don't hear many complaints. This national story is devastating. In fact, it's kind of surprising, isn't it? I have in my mind Uber is kind of a Google-type friendly, modern, we-get-it workplace where Don Draper doesn't live, for crying out loud.
Well, the tech companies have been suffering from bad press for the last few years about the treatment of women in their companies, about how women feel like they can't rise within some tech companies. And now this, these kinds of stories are, whether they're true or not, are hitting Uber. And, they're going to have to react to this in a strong way. They're going to have to, build their brand back up. Because if, Uber is so ubiquitous, it's become a verb. I'm going to Uber somewhere instead of if I'm going to taxi somewhere.
Uber over, yeah.
Yeah, and they cannot lose that brand recognition by having this sort of things affect their, you know, their appeal, especially to, you know, to people who feel like they have a choice like we do here in Chicago.
Yeah, no kidding. So some Uber drivers are stopped driving, they say, and 200,000 people have stopped using the app that is taking rides from them. But still, it's like a multi-billion dollar company. It's amazing how successful it's been.
It's amazing how and how wide and far it has gone compared to what we were a few years ago when it was just cabs everywhere. And now it's harder to find a cab. And you find I keep running into cab drivers who have medical books in the front of their cabs because they're studying to be, you know, medical technicians or something else because they can't make it as cab drivers
anymore. Maybe that's the way it should be. In fact, frankly, a lot of the Uber drivers that I've been with look like cab drivers. A lot of them seem to be foreign American. You know,
a lot of them were cab drivers.
No kidding, really.
Yeah,
Can they do both?
I don't know that it'd be practical to do both because of the way you have to lease your cab. But I know some people are both Uber and Lyft drivers.
It's 148. My number is 312-981-7200. If you had an especially good or bad experience, I'd just be kind of curious. Mary Wisniewski's in our studio, and her story will be on the front page of the Chicago Tribune on Sunday about a different transportation issue. That is about tickets for bicyclists. I chuckle because I have only recently discovered that if ever there is two groups opposed to each other, it's bicyclists and pedestrians or bicyclists and automobiles in big cities these days. We'll pick it up here in a minute on WGN.
Hi, it's Steve.
You know, the other question I had was how much, let's go back to our original point. Mary Wisniewski's in our studio. She's the transportation writer for the Chicago Tribune. Time magazine has a piece out today, and it says 200,000 people have dropped Uber in January alone as part of the hashtag delete Uber movement because of all of the bad publicity they've been receiving. And I thought, well, that's terrible. I mean, if it's a terrible company, I shouldn't support that. But I thought when I use Uber, I'm helping that driver and I'm helping me. How much of the money when I use Uber goes to the company?
The rule of thumb with rideshare for both Uber and Lyft has been about 20%, and that goes to the company. And
wow.
Uber drivers report that they make about $15 an hour, $16 an hour. Lyft drivers report making a bit more because they get tips. And all, but that's before expenses. If you're driving for Uber or Lyft, you have a lot of expenses. You have to pay for the gas, and you have to pay for the wear and tear on your car.
Yeah, and you're driving a Camry or something that's reasonably nice that people want to get in. I mean, I was in a Camry the other day, and I thought this guy is not making that much money. He is paying for the gas. We just hit a pothole in Chicago. That can't be good. As he's trying to get me somewhere, and then 20% of what I'm giving, which, and by the way, it was less expensive than a cab, 20% goes to Uber. I'm amazed they get as many drivers as they do.
The other thing that's going to change for rideshare drivers and other people in the gig economy is if the Congress manages to get rid of the Affordable Care Act, a lot of people who work for Uber and companies like that depend on it for their health insurance. So they might be having to pay more in health care.
I saw that, and I was surprised. So Uber provides health care for its drivers?
No. What I've heard from drivers is that they sign up for insurance through the Affordable Care Act.
Oh, I see, as independent.
Yeah, because they're gig workers,
right.
And they, you know, this might be a part-time job for them, or full-time.
But so they're not really making that much money then, are they? If I were a cab driver, though, I presume cab drivers make more money?
It's hard to say right now because of the way the cab business has gone down.
Yeah.
You're not going to get rich. If you were planning to get rich being a cab driver, I'd suggest something else.
Well, it's funny because so here on Michigan Avenue, we're 435 North Michigan Avenue, and if you are just standing around these streets or the side streets like St. Clair or Illinois, but, you know, right here off the Magnificent Mile, say, you'll see people hailing cabs. It's a great cab town. It always has been. But just as much, you'll see people on the side streets or just around the corner doing the Uber thing, and you can spot them a mile away. And I don't know what the percentage is, but I bet it's pretty close, one to the other.
it's getting you can see it just watching the cars go by. You can see the Uber logos on the front of the cars and the Lyft logos on the front of the cars, and you can tell that these are not families driving together. It's a guy in the front of the car and somebody sitting in the back playing with their phone.
I know, yeah. Which, to be honest with you, not to get all warm and fuzzy about this with you, but I think there's something great about that too. I guess it's in a way the same relationship you have with a cab driver. This is a person who isn't your friend, but you could share a close space with them and have a conversation with them. And it's kind of neat to see the market putting people together who might not otherwise share a common space.
Oh, yeah. And then you can have great conversations with people. Only one time have I felt that an Uber driver overshared a little bit with
me.
What
was that?
It was a lady who was otherwise a very nice person and a good driver who told me about her past car accidents, which had happened in the last month. This made me a little nervous about riding with her.
Of all the things you should share,
right, exactly.
That is not one of them. Polly, jump in here real quick. You had a question about insurance, right?
Hi. I've actually done a little bit of my own individual research. I'm an insurance broker. So whenever I get in an Uber or Lyft, I say, what is the insurance requirement? Because you're driving really commercially, have you notified your insurance agent? Do you pay more for insurance or have you not? And except with one exception, every driver has said, no, I just have my regular auto insurance. I've never, notified my agent. One Uber driver told me that Uber provided blanket insurance for their drivers, but that was only in one case. So I was curious what you know about that.
I got about 25 seconds. What do you say about that generally?
The rideshare companies do provide insurance for their drivers, but only when they're actually, when they have a passenger, that not when they're, driving around looking for fares. And so, and the cutoffs between when that starts and when it doesn't start are a little bit fuzzy sometimes. And in fact, there's a new law firm that started that's focusing on this issue.
Yeah, a couple of guys have a boutique firm, and it's all about Uber insurance and crashes, isn't it?
Right. Well, it's about people's rights, passengers' rights, drivers' rights.
What a niche. Mary, nice to see you again. Thanks for coming into our studio.
Thanks for having me.
Page one in the Chicago Tribune. She's got a story this Sunday in the Tribune. It's 1:57 on WGN. Thank you, Steve. The first part of the show was that press conference, if you will, the joint statements and some questions from President Trump and Angela Merkel. You heard some of that in the news. Typically, I will only be talking about President Trump, the administration, and all of the things that are swirling around that these days. In our 2 o'clock hour in this segment, think Trump at 2. So we talked about Uber earlier, and we were going to talk more about Northwestern. The press conference got in the way. You understand that. But I'm reserving this spot. So please don't think we're always talking about Trump. But as much as it's fascinating and important and we want to talk about it, we reserve this spot for that.
Sean, are you saying that despite the findings, the bipartisan findings of the Senate Intelligence Committee?
No, they're not findings. There's a statement out today. They have not begun this. As you know, yesterday or 2 days ago, the Department of Justice asked for an additional week. So the statement clearly says that at this time that they don't believe that. They have yet to go through the information. The Department of Justice, as you know, has not supplied this.
Are you saying that the president still stands by his allegation that President Obama ordered wiretapping or surveillance of Trump Tower, despite the fact that the Senate Intelligence Committee says they see no indication that it happened? Does the president still stand by the allegation?
First of all, he stands by it, but again, you're mischaracterizing what happened today. At the same time, they acknowledge that they have not been in contact with the Department of Justice. So, but again, I go back to what I said at the beginning. It's interesting. At the same time, where were you coming to the defense of that same Intelligence Committee and those members when they said there was no connection to Russia? So you want to comment and you want to perpetuate a false narrative. The bottom line is that the president said last night that he will be providing, that there would be additional information coming forward.
2, 3, 4, do the Sean Spicer cha-cha.
There's a ton of media reports out there that indicate that something was going on during the 2016
election.
They
went on like that for a while, and they just maintained their position that the president has some information, the investigation isn't complete, and for you to assume that that means that there is no evidence to support their claim is you being just as premature in your judgment as you may think the administration is. At least that's how I read that or heard that. And trust me, I've listened to it more than once. Aaron Blake joins us, the White House or the senior political reporter on line 7 for the Washington Post. Aaron, thanks for joining us. You're on WGN. How are you?
Doing great today. How are you guys?
Pretty good, but, you know, utterly confused. Is that kind of where that conversation is, that they say this thing is still being investigated, neither of us knows what, you know, you can't know an unknown, as Rumsfeld once said, so it's wrong to assume, with even though there is no evidence, that it didn't happen. Isn't that the position right now?
Well, that's their position on this right now. They've also had more than a week and a half, during which time they could have come forward with this evidence. Apparently, we're hearing now that the Justice Department has sent something over to the House Intelligence Committee. We don't know what that is precisely right now. But you know, I think the big takeaway, if there is one, from that press conference is that the White House is really kind of trying to change what we're talking about here. The allegation was that President Obama directed surveillance towards Trump, that he was behind this, that it was targeted surveillance. The White House is now talking much more in terms of the idea that Trump or his associates wound up in some unrelated surveillance that was targeted at somebody else. And so they may produce some evidence that shows that, but that's not really what Trump was alleging in the first place. And so this is really kind of what I would call a shell game that they're playing right now and trying to change the actual thing that they're trying to prove.
Well, they're being petulant about that, I agree. But I almost think we should at least entertain their broader notion now. I mean, is it possible, though, that there was some general surveillance going on of the Trump campaign and that the president or his people had anything to do with that, wiretaps or otherwise?
Well, you never want to rule anything out, especially something that happens behind closed doors like this. And I think that's why we're all careful to say that this is an allegation that doesn't have any evidence, rather than that this is an allegation that is untrue. We just don't know that. What we do know is that James Clapper, the former director of national intelligence, has said that there was no FISA warrant that was you know, meant to monitor on Trump Tower. At the FBI has issued somewhat of a denial in this case. So, you know, there's always a possibility that there's something there, and we need to be careful about that. I don't doubt that there is something that leads the White House to believe that their case is actually accurate. But it's coming time where they could have produced this information a long time ago, and they still haven't done that, at least not publicly, and we will have yet to see what they provided to the intelligence committees.
And when the story first broke, I remember one of the first questions that Matt Lauer put to Kellyanne Conway or somebody put to somebody was, if the president is making this accusation, presumably because he knows, he could come forward and say it at any time. And then Sean Spicer said that would be inappropriate. That's kind of where that's their defense against not coming up with the goods themselves, right?
Yeah, there was even one point where Spicer was asked a similar question and cited the separation of powers for some reason. I wasn't clear on exactly what he was getting at, but he was basically saying that Trump can't provide this information to congressional investigators because they're a separate branch of government. It was just bizarre. I think that they're just kind of constantly treading water on this, trying to figure out a way to explain it away or at least justify the initial claim. And it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense why the president couldn't simply say the things that his claim is based upon. And I think that's because it is based upon news reports that he's seen. And those news reports, as we've seen, you know, dissected, including here at the Washington Post, are based on a couple anonymous sources. They are from foreign journalists based in the United Kingdom, in fact. And they are claims that reporters here at the Washington Post and elsewhere have tried for months to confirm and haven't been able to do so. So the claim certainly invites its own scrutiny, you never know exactly what happened, but this is still a president of the United States who made a claim that we just don't know about. at this point.
You know, if we all just, I used the word petulant a minute ago, but if we could all just come to the conclusion, I mean, the elephant in the room, let's just assume this is true. Maybe it's not, but I think this is the way it's going to play out, that there is no evidence because it didn't happen. And the president got out in front of his skis with a tweet, angry about something, and we all know that. I almost wonder, since he's not going to say uncle, if we should all just move past that point because there's nothing there. If there is, we'll evidently find out soon enough. But maybe we should end our preoccupation with it. I wonder who's being more obstinate here. Do you know what I mean, Aaron?
Yeah, I get the argument, and this is something that we've chewed over quite a bit in the past when, you know, we had a lot of conversations about whether we should pay attention to Trump's tweets, for instance, whether that yeah. was something we should cover as news.
Yeah, this is an example.
This is maybe the best example of that. I tend to disagree. I think, you know, this is a president of the United States alleging that a predecessor of his, you know, engaged in basically a Watergate-esque political scandal, and if that were true, it would need to be found out. If it's not true, we have to find out yeah. where this came from, and you know, it goes to the credibility thing that the president, you know, whether we can trust the president, what the president says. And so I think it's worth digging into, but I agree to you that there is a possibility that there are certain American, you know, people in America who are going to think that this is overkill and that we're just taking this all way too seriously.
Even though he doubles down. I mean, every opportunity he's had to back away, and their latest, you know, backpedaling is, well, we meant it in a broader sense, but they're not, no, shoot, now help me out on this, Aaron. Is the president now saying that he didn't mean his line was tapped? They're unequivocal about that, or are they still maintaining the possibility that, in fact, his phone line was tapped?
They're saying it was general surveillance,
yeah,
basically.
Okay. Yeah.
So, but yeah, you know, I don't know whether that really it makes a whole lot of difference. I mean, it's all kind of in the same area. But he just did. He did just reference this at his press conference with Angela Merkel. So it doesn't seem to be something he's just going to clam up about all of a sudden and try to hope goes away.
Yeah, he made a joke about it. He said, look, they were listening on your phone calls, and evidently we have nothing in common now. They were doing something to me. So he's certainly maintaining that narrative. However, finally, he's parsing some of those words. It's 2:21. All right, Aaron, I'll let you go. Senior political reporter for The Washington Post. Aaron, it's good to read you. It's good to talk to you. I hope you can join us again.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
2:21. And really, we didn't even get in much to that press conference today, but that was really, really strange. It was the president never misses an opportunity to make the points that he wants made. And sometimes the decorum is really strange. And like we all know, this is a president who's writing his own book. So I guess it's not surprising that he would sort of throw traditional decorum away. But when he's bragging about something or just making a point that seems to be a little off topic, it can be a little jarring because not only are we not talking about that right now, but the lady flew in from Germany. She's standing right there. So I had to chuckle at times at some of the things that were happening today. And then immediately they start fact-checking one of the statements that he made. We'll get to that point in a minute on WGN. Dave Anna with the call, of course, heard here on WGN yesterday. What a fun game that was. Interesting because people are describing the painful, dumb, that's in quotes from the USA Today, today, the dumb play that player for Vanderbilt made at the end of the game. They didn't need to foul. He thought maybe they did. Stop the clock. You know how that strategy works. The end of a basketball game, his team was up one. He didn't realize that. And he's a storied kid, by the way. He has been benched three times by the team. He's the one that walking to the bench one time threw his gum. Bryce Drew's had nothing but trouble with him, but he's also one of their best players. At one point in the season, he said he'd found God and was better. He was the reason they were in that game in the second half. He said himself he's the reason they lost. And so he's owning it. But it's just ironic because if you said, who are the smart kids? You'd say the Northwesterns, the Vanderbilts. This was a Vandy kid who did not know what was happening. I blame the coach on that more than I do the player, by the way. The players play and the coach has to make sure everybody knows what they're doing. At the end of the day, they still had 14 seconds or so left to come back. The thing that always surprises me, shocked me, and disappointed me in yesterday's game, just from a basketball standpoint, is that then they just decided to dribble around the perimeter and then launch a really long shot. They had more time in that game to get a better shot off and yet beat Northwestern. They didn't, and we'll take that win any way we can get it. Time magazine has an interesting story online right now. Who wins March Madness in the classroom? Time senior writer Sean Gregory joins us now on WGN. Hey, Sean, it's John Williams. How are you?
Hey, John, how are you?
Good. Happy St. Patrick's Day.
Same to you. Same to you.
I presume you're Irish?
I am Irish, yes. I'm going to a nice St. Patrick's Day dinner, and we'll enjoy the papal dispensation on corned beef tonight. So, very exciting.
In some cities, I was talking to my newsman, Steve Bertrand, that's a big deal, you know?
Yeah.
The papal dispensation for corned beef on Friday during Lent.
Yeah. Yep.
On St. Patrick's
get
Day.
It.
So, is this something that Time Magazine, I've seen something like this before. Do you guys always do this?
Yeah, we started partnering with New America, which is a think tank, a nonpartisan think tank in D.C. Probably we've done this the last 3 or 4 years. We do it with the college football, too. And, you know, they've used different formulas, but the basic... You know, there's no perfect way to measure this stuff. I mean, and so you could cut it a million different ways. But what they do is they start with the team's graduation success rate. It's an NCAA measure that basically is kind of tracking how many players you've recruited and how many are on track to graduate, basically are staying eligible.
Yeah.
And then, you know, that's kind of the baseline. And then you get bonuses in their formula if you graduate players at the same kind of rate as men in the men's tournament, so
sure.
So men in the rest of the school, and then you know schools with high overall graduation rates get a little bonus too. So you know it's not that complicated. It's a little wonky, but that's basically the gist of it. And
sure.
And yeah, we play it out the brackets, and it's usually has some fun debate, and the team that quote unquote wins it, usually there's a lot of prideful alums. That's basically kind of how it shakes out every
and
time.
Or a consolation prize. I mean, only one team's going to win it, but at least you can say, well, our guys are real student athletes. But isn't would you say this is true though, Sean, that in fact these schools are well represented academically? Generally, the graduation rates for these schools are pretty high. I know there's some exceptions, but as I was reading through it, I thought, well, those numbers sound pretty good.
Yeah, for you're talking about for most of the teams in the tournament.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. No, I mean there are some stragglers,
UCLA.
UCLA did not have an impressive showing, but there were a lot. I think there were 12 schools with this graduation success rate of 100%, and I haven't gone back and looked, but I think that's pretty high, higher than in past years. And so, yeah, you got to give schools like, you know, Notre Dame, Butler, just reading some of them, Dayton, Duke.
Vermont.
Yeah, you know,
here, let me
Vermont.
Just do the list. That's an interesting point. Vermont, Winthrop, Princeton, Butler, Notre Dame, Middle Tennessee, Dayton, Duke, Creighton, Villanova, and Kansas, along with Bucknell, are the 12 schools that graduate everybody every year from their men's basketball program. That is a senior and eligible to graduate.
Right. And just to keep in mind, but like, so for Kansas, for example, they do send players to the pros, right?
Right.
And that will leave early, but it doesn't in the GSR, that does not count against you.
In some metrics, it does. Some people will penalize you for that, but I don't think it should. If the guy goes off to play pro ball and therefore technically didn't graduate, that's a completely different conversation.
Well, right. So what happened in the NCAA, the statistic that is the federal statistic was always getting quoted for, you know, basketball teams' graduation rates. And the federal statistics, if you leave early to go after your junior year to go play in the NBA, it counts against you. You count as not having graduated and having gone to the school. Basically, you're a zero in the numerator and one in the denominator, you know, so it kind of hurts your overall rate. But the NCAA, you know, so this a lot of the federal rates, the teams had very low rates, and so the NCAA thought that wasn't fair, and, you know, and other advocates thought it wasn't fair. Why should You know, I remember, I think UConn was a team where they had, you know, the federal rate was really, really low, but they had a lot of guys going to the NBA, which is they're going to make a living in the NBA. So I totally understand that argument. So, but the GSR, it's a lot of, I know it's a lot of anachronisms and kind of jargon, but this graduation success rate. So for Kansas, for example, they're at 100, but it's basically saying the players that are on the team are on track to graduate. And so if I was a Kansas star and I leave after my junior year, it doesn't hurt Kansas's rate as long as I leave in academic good standing.
Well, I've never understood the conversation that says, no, you should get your degree, because the object of a degree is right. to then go get a job as an accountant or a something. Well, if I can go make $1 million, I'm going to make more than the accountant anyway. I can always go back and get the degree. Okay, so then let's just cut to the chase. Quick, how did Northwestern do academically in these brackets?
So Northwestern, I'm looking, they did very well overall. They were the sixth highest out of the 68 teams. The problem, though, in the way the pairings played out, they ran into the champion, Bucknell, who was ranked, who had the top ranking and actually won the academic championship. So Northwestern did very well. They just ran into a buzzsaw of the Bucknell Bison.
But they did they do better than – I'm trying to remember now. So Northwestern squares off against Vanderbilt, obviously, in the first round. They're in the same quarterfinal in the West as Bucknell, and Bucknell wins it all. Bucknell is your overall winner in this. Northwestern, I'm trying to remember now if they even made it past Vanderbilt, but
They did. And then they won their theoretical second round matchup against South Dakota State, and then so they got to the Sweet 16, and they faced Bucknell in the Sweet 16.
The final four were
Duke, which is kind of the really only school that mirrors.
Yeah,
they have a very good shot at making the Final Four on the basketball court, and they made it in these academic rankings. Bucknell on one side, and on the other side it was Vermont plays against Winthrop in South Carolina.
How about that, Vermont and Winthrop? Well, I'm glad for those kids on the floor that if they didn't, you know, do as well on the basketball court, that's a good academic measure for them.
I think that these rankings are cool, and you know, I think it hopefully, you know, might be a little Pollyannish, but something to shoot for the schools to if they don't have great national championship teams, if they're graduating kids and kids are, you know, staying eligible and getting an education, that's pretty important. So if this is any kind of consolation for the Vermonts and Winthrops of the world, I don't think that's a bad thing.
I don't think that's a small consolation. Sean Gregory writes for Time Magazine, senior writer there, and you can read the Who Wins March Madness in the Classroom piece right now online, along with David Johnson, his colleague. It's nice to talk to you. Thanks for joining us this afternoon.
No problem.
Yeah, it's a fun piece. It's 2:49. Speaking of quizzes, I have a Numbers in the News quiz. And we follow the news. You do, too. You're listening to WGN Radio. So let's play Numbers in the News. You get an A or a B. That is, I'll ask you a question. You have two options as answers. We'll give them to you. We'll give you a lifeline of Steve Bertrand or Kim or somebody in the newsroom. Elif can be another lifeline as well. 10 questions we've got. Let's see if we can get through as many as we can. Let's see how many you can get right. Call 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. You'll understand how the game works when you hear it. It's called Numbers in the News. Randy. Hey, Randy, this is John. How are you? Welcome to the show.
Well, hey, buddy. Hi. I'm glad you're back, really.
So here's what I've got for you. A few quiz questions with that boom, 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 boom thinking music in the background. You'll hear that next time we play. You can get a lifeline from the newsroom if you don't know the answer. Are you ready?
Okay.
How many games have the Northwestern Wildcats won in the NCAA men's basketball tournament in the history of the school? Is the answer zero or is the answer one?
I guess.
One is the correct answer, sir. Question. You were going to go with zero. I kind of saved you there, didn't I?
I'm going to wait in the truck until you're done talking. There you go.
Okay, ready? Here's number two. The average amount owed per federal student loan. I don't know if you heard this number this week, but it was in the news. How much does the average student loan, how much do people owe on average? Is it A, $18,600, or is it B, $30,600?
I'd have to go B.
B, he says, 30,600. Ding, ding, ding. That's a correct answer. Question number three. Pi Day was this week. That is March 14th. To four digits, what is pi? Is it 3.141 or is it 3.147?
Really? 3.14.
3.147 is wrong. It's 141.
Well, I give it a shot.
That's all I can ask for.
I'm a welder. Hey, Liz, work with me.
All right, how about this one then? How many Americans fill out NCAA brackets, Mr. Welder? Is it 17 million or 50 million?
Was it 17 million or what was it?
Or 50 million.
50 million. I would have to say the first one, 17.
17 million is wrong. It's
wow, that's terrible. 50,
I know. I know that's not good for
disheartening. I'm sorry.
That's bad for American productivity, isn't it?
I'm staying away, but okay, keep going.
Nope, I'm out of time now, Randy, but this is just kind of a trial effort here. We're getting all the bells and whistles figured out, so you're sort of our beta contestant. I appreciate you joining us this afternoon.
Well, I appreciate talking to you, too, John. Take care, Rich.
Stay well.
We'll see.
Okay, yeah, we'll do that again next week. We'll get it all figured out, but that's kind of how it works. It's 2:57, and the news is around the corner here on WGN. So beautiful people just walked into the studio. One of them is Pete McMurray. Yeah. But the other one, hello, my name is John. How are you?
Hello, John. My name is Jane.
I heard you Saturday night on this very fine radio station.
Well, thanks for listening. You and my mom.
Was it
great.
Healthy Living or Healthy Matters?
Healthy, so Living Healthy Living Chicago Healthy is Chicago. The TV show that airs on WGN-TV.
And you were filling in, or do you always do a Saturday?
No,
night
I was filling in for Amy Guth that night.
That's
so
she
took a day off, probably going to the Irish parades, and she let me sit in. It was really fun.
Hey,
a
guys,
great time.
I'm here.
Oh, hi, Pete.
Yeah.
Hi, Pete.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I love seeing you.
It would help if you'd wear something bright and green, and then you guys have to tweet a picture of you, because not only are you beautiful, but wow, are you green.
This is a great suit. Yeah. Shamrock suit, buddy.
You don't get to wear that very often.
No.
Once a year.
Once a year. I got a week.
It is money well spent.
Yeah.